The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's a great pleasure to introduce Sue Grafton to you. She's...
Yes, come out.
This lady, as you probably know, writes with the letters of the alphabet in mind. And she's gone through the alphabet from A, and I'll show you that book before we're through, to U. U. Five more to come. Right?
Yes, ma'am.
By way of introduction, Sue does a lot of work in California, which is where she spends a good deal of her time with her husband and all the other family members that come to visit.
Yes, ma'am.
I've always been curious about how you and Marcia and Sarah, Marcia Muller and Sarah Paretsky, broke the wall. Before these ladies came along, you had goody-goody little Miss Marples. And they're wonderful. But it was up to Sue and the other two ladies to say, okay, a woman can be a private eye. Can you address it?
Well, Marcia came first. I always make that clear. She published Edwin of the Iron Shoes in 1977. And I had met her, and I met Bill Pronzini at that point. But when it came time to try a mystery novel, in part I did it because my father wrote mystery fiction in the 40s. I was working in Hollywood at the time, which I refer to as doing 1 to 15 in Hollywood. And I was not a happy camper. As I've said on other occasions, in Hollywood I learned two things about myself. One, I'm not a team player. Two, I'm not a good sport. So I decided that instead of being cranky and unpleasant and bitter, I would find a way out of Hollywood. So I decided to do A is for Alibi, in part because there was an agent who said to my agent, oh, Grafton can write character, but she cannot do plot. I thought, in a pig's eye, bub, watch me. So it just pissed me off. I thought, all right, I will teach myself to plot. And what better way to do it than the mystery novel? And since my father had written mystery novels in the 40s and 50s, I decided to give it a whirl. And so that's what I did. That's beautiful.
This was the first in 1982. Curious also, when did you decide not to do real time with your main characters?
Well, that was all part of the same process. I look back on it, I think how cheeky I was to imagine I could write 26 books. I mean, what are the chances? Never having done one in my life. But back to that other question about Sarah and Marcia and I, when I decided to do a mystery novel, I sat down, I had to teach myself how to write a mystery novel. At the same time, I was teaching myself private eye procedure, police procedure, California criminal law, toxicology, every other kind of ology you can think of. And I was so far out of my element that when it came time to design the prime character, I thought to myself, I'm going to play that part myself. Because I felt that being female was my only area of expertise. And I understood that I don't have a clue how men think. So aside from my worries about making a fool of myself in many other areas, I thought, let me not be so silly as to write from a man's point of view. So I wasn't actually, I'm sorry to say this, making a feminist statement. It was pure desperation.
That's an interesting comment, Sue, because there's so many writers who write in the voice of the opposite gender. Do you think, or can you name anybody that you think is extremely successful?
Oddly enough, I think some men write from a female point of view better than the other way around. Mm. I think it can be done, yeah. But I don't know why that should be a fact of the matter, but it just seems to me.
I don't know if the brain waves are different or not.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you men generally don't shave their legs, you know.
You spent a lot of time in the film world, if we will. Has that influenced your decision not...
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, not to let the rights go for the films. Yeah. I mean, we'll never see Kinsey on the screen.
That's exactly right. Early on, I would get inquiries about the film and television rights, and I would send a letter that said one of two things. Either I would say, I would rather roll naked in broken glass than sell you this character. Or I would say, I would rather have a root canal, which I've never had, but I live in terror of. So now they don't ask me so much anymore, you know, which is kind of pleasant. But part of that decision, aside from common sense, was influenced by the fact that when Lawrence Block sold his books to Hollywood, he was writing about a white male Jewish burglar, and they cast Whoopi Goldberg. So I'm picturing Eddie Murphy playing Kinsey Millhone. And I just don't think it's going to fly, folks. So they always act like they're doing you a favor while they trash your work. They're not interested in the books, trust me. They're interested in the character and what those contracts, here's how they read. You sell Kinsey Millhone in perpetuity throughout the universe in technologies known and technologies yet to be invented. Now, who's going to make a deal like that? You know?
I'm still interested in your spotting your main character in what time frame.
Oh, thank you. Yes, yeah. I how, sort of ducked that one, yeah. Didn't I?
What I was gonna, how old is she now, 39?
No, she's 38. She's just turning 38 in this book.
Oh,
the
my.
Next. I know. Well, part of it was, I'm thinking to myself, even if I managed to write a book a year, which turned out to be a preposterous notion, if you take 32 and add 26, it's going to start getting silly toward the end. And I wanted Kinsey to be believable in her physical fitness and her courage and her ability to run for her life if she had to do it. So I decided to age her 1 year for every 2.5 books. So little by little, she's floating back in time. You know, I've moved on. When I started writing the books, she was 32 and I was 42. Now she's just about to turn 38 and I'm 69. Now, I don't get it.
Lawrence Block has that problem, doesn't he?
Yeah,
with his Scudder series.
Oh. Well, I thought he didn't quite age Matt Scudder.
He's got him up there.
Okay.
And, you know, his spinoff characters aren't carrying it. He hasn't done a Scudder in some years, if you know
Lawrence Block's
work. He did age his character. Scudder was his name. And... another question. They always ask him, and I'm sure they always ask you, how much of Kinsey is you and how much of you is Kinsey?
Well, and here's how I answer that. Do you like her? Because if you like her, I'll admit it's a projection of myself. If you don't care for her, then I'm just going to disavow any connection, whatever. I originally just funneled all my dark stuff into her. You know, all my nastiness, of which I have an abundance, as it turns out. And I thought it might be offensive to people, but people seem to think it's funny. You know, she's very unpretentious. She has a very keen eye for human absurdity. And she just, in her own head, calls it the way she sees it. I work very hard to keep her life size. She is not a role model for anybody. The fate of the free world does not hang in the balance, you know. She is flawed. She's cranky. She's inconsistent. And she has her foibles, and I think that's what makes her accessible to readers. So some of the questions we will confess. Somebody asked if she could get a cat, and I'll tell you why not, okay? Same reason she doesn't have a boyfriend, and here's how it goes. Here's Kinsey Millhone. She's about to go off and chase a bad guy. I don't want her to have to pick up the phone and say, "Sweetie, would you take the pork chops out of the freezer?" And if she had a cat, if she's about to hit the road, the reader would be thinking, "Don't forget to feed the cat." See, so I don't want you distracted by these other issues. So I did give her an air fern at one time. I thought that was pretty cool. If you've ever had an air fern, you will know they smell like feet, which is not that pleasant. But
do you have a favorite one or two of your 21 books? Are they all your children?
Yeah, they're all mine. Looking back, some seem easier, some seem harder. Lately, they've been getting harder and harder and harder and harder. So the easy ones were apparently at the front end of the alphabet. J is for Judgment is a favorite of mine because, I'll tell you this story, I was writing J, and see, here's what's true about me. I always wanted to be perfect. I wanted to be a really good Girl Scout, you know, and write, turn my papers in on time. And so I've been getting letters, probably from some of you, complaining about my trashy mouth. And so without even meaning to, I'd begun to self-censor. So I'd be ready to write one of the really good words, and I'd be thinking, "Now, Sue, you don't have to use that word." So my prose got very flat, and I realized that Kinsey Millhone was mad at me. So for about 2 weeks, I walked around my house going, and finally, it's like she came back to life. But when I got to J is for Judgment, because the prose was so flat and I could recognize that, I got a phone call one day from a Hollywood producer, one of three that I would ever work for again. And of those three, one is dead. And so I probably won't work for him. This gal said to me, "Do you remember when you said to me that if I ever found a therapist who was good with creative people, I should tell you?" I said, "Sure." I swear to God, I never said that to her, but okay. So I'm going, "Sure." She said, "I have a guy, and right now he is magic, and I don't know how long the magic is going to last." She gave me his number. 20 minutes later, I was on the phone to him. I was living in Santa Barbara at the time, and he was down in L.A. So I went down and met him once, and we did phone therapy for 3 months. I talked to him once a week, and he was a Jungian, and I don't know how many of you know about Jungian therapy. It, to me, I was used to boohoo therapy. you know, you're mad at your parents, you blame everybody. That is so useless. If you're doing boohoo therapy, quit. You know, save your money. I will help you. But Jungian therapy is very abstract, and it's very intellectual. And I kept thinking to myself, this can't possibly help me. Within 3 months, he totally turned my head around because he taught me the difference between ego and shadow. Ego was that part of me who wanted to be perfect. I didn't want to be criticized. I wanted everybody to think I was nice. And shadow is all the pieces of ourselves that we repress and repudiate and deny, all the things we pretend we're not. And I had gotten so good at tamping down my shadow that I lost touch. Shadow is where all your creative energy is. So once you get perfect on the surface, you can't get to the good stuff. So he said to me at one point, "What if you turned this manuscript in 6 months late?" I was about to cough up a hairball. And he said, "Furthermore, what if you turned it in 6 months late and it wasn't very good?" And I was, you know, blacking out. The thought was so repellent to me. And then he said, "Do you know what? God will still let you breathe." And that's what set me free. I thought, shoot, if God will still let me breathe, I'll still be in business. So Jay is for Judgment is a shadow-written book. I gave up any hope of doing it right. I just surrendered to the process, and I let the book write itself. And so that shifted my entire writing process. So that's my favorite.
You talk about process. Would you care to describe your writing process?
Sure.
Do you get up in the morning at 5 o'clock?
Usually. No. I go to my desk usually 8:30 or 9. In a good week, I walk 5.4 miles a day because writers sit on their big fat fannies all day long. And I find writing very stressful. So I either exercise at the beginning of the day or at the end of the day. But generally, I'm at my desk about 8:30 or 9, break briefly for lunch, and go back in the afternoon. But the important thing about, see, I can sit in my office for hours, and do you know what I'm doing? Playing Free Cell on my computer because I will do anything to avoid the writing process. But what I do is I keep a journal for every novel that I write. The journals are on my computer. They run usually 100 pages, single-spaced. And for every novel, I have maybe 5 or 6 or 7 journals. So at the end of a book, a manuscript will be 500 double-spaced pages. The journals will be 395 single-spaced pages. And that means that for every line I write, there is a mass of material that never makes it to the book. Most of it is my whining. You know, I just whine and agonize over these books. And so the journals are a long conversation I have with myself about the writing process. So every time I start a book, in my journals I have elaborate charts of all the books I've done so I can keep track of what I'm doing because I don't want to repeat myself. So I have a chart of the gender of every killer, the gender of the victim, the motive for the crime, and the nature of the ending of the book. Then I have a separate set of charts which are what I call log lines. You know, in A is for alibi. Kinsey Millhone is hired to prove the innocence of a woman who's just gotten out of prison for the murder of her husband. And B is for burglar. Kinsey Millhone is hired to get a signature on a minor document. And that's the way I work my way through. So I can make sure that even the setups aren't the same. In my experience, private investigators do not involve themselves in active homicide cases. That's what the police do, and the police will not appreciate Ms. Kinsey Millhone tromping around or their crime scenes. So I have to find legitimate private eye business by which I can work her way into a story that usually comes down to murder, which is sometimes why I use old crimes or cold cases, because generally the police are not as protective of those.
I think one of the strengths of the series, I hope you agree with me, is that you don't have to start with A.
Oh.
You can pick it up in the middle, and I think perhaps that use of the non-real time helps with that.
The books are self-contained. Certain threads continue, but it's not necessary. I always liken it to meeting somebody at a cocktail party. You know, you have that chat, and if you're interested, you have more chats. But I suggest people start with A. If you don't like A, you're not going to like the rest of them. A's out in paperback, you know, so you can borrow it from a friend. So if you don't like it, no harm, no foul.
But don't you think, well, I don't know if you think, the writing has become not more sophisticated, but cleaner, finished, as you've gone along with it.
You are too nice.
Come on.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one thing. You mentioned your father, and he did write some crime novels.
Yeah.
Did he have any influence on you as a writer? I mean, I know he died. We talked about this. He died a few months before Alibi was published.
Right.
But he was there for her whole career as a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if he had much influence with you.
He influenced me in that when I was growing up, my father was a municipal bond attorney, and his best advice to me was, don't become an attorney, you will be bored to tears. So that's why I'm not representing you tonight with your legal woes. He was just passionate about mystery fiction. We, in those days, see, I'm a very old person, we used to go to this corner drugstore and they would sell used paperbacks for 25 cents a piece. These were the old noir pulp fiction. And we would get just a stack of books and bring them home. And we had one of those revolving drugstore racks. And so my mother would read these books, and on the front in pencil, she would mark them dirty or dull or good. And we were allowed to read anything we wanted because they knew that as after we read a few of the dirty ones, we'd figure out how dull they were, you know. So in those days, children had a lot more freedom. I had a lot of physical freedom that kids just can't have today. Life is too dangerous. At any rate, he talked a lot about the writing process. So when I was 8 and 10, this is what I heard at home. My family are all about books. My sister was a librarian who's retired now. But we sat and we read books. And so when he talked about writing, I just didn't think it had any particular application to me. I imagined I would be a teacher or a nurse. Now, I'm really phobic about needles, and I did work for a while in the medical field. I love medicine. I love that. Worked in hospitals, little white uniform, little white shoes, but I think there's more money in the business I'm in now. So, but at a certain point, I began to write, as you all must have. You know, in high school, those sappy poems we wrote, it was such melodrama. And I wrote short stories of a sort of tawdry sort. But I did, in 1962, I took an adult education class at UCLA taught by Robert Kirsch, who was then the book editor of the book review editor of the LA Times. And he persuaded me to write a novel, which I did. I was 22 years old. You can imagine how much I knew about the world. Fortunately, when you're 22, you think you know something about the world. But that novel was never published. The second novel I wrote was never published. Third novel I wrote was never published. The fourth was published. The fifth was published. Six and seven were never published. And A is for Alibi is the eighth book I wrote. But I can truly say it was my father's influence in retrospect. You know, at the time, I didn't know how many of those lessons were sinking in. He used, you know. Oh.
Terrific. If you ever find his books, they also had a little bit of a series.
Mm-hmm.
The Rat?
He wrote two books of a projected eight-book series based on a British nursery rhyme about a little old lady trying to get a pig over a stile. So his first book was The Rat Began to Gnaw the Rope, which won the Mary Roberts Reinhardt Award of 1943. Then he wrote The Rope Began to Hang the Butcher, and I have part of a third manuscript that he never finished called The Butcher Began to Kill the Ox. I have no notes, and I never talked to him about how I work. So even reading the manuscripts, I don't understand where he was coming from or where he intended to go. So in some sense, it's been suggested that I finish his book, but truly, I feel we all have our own work in this world, and it is not my place to finish his, nor any posthumous writer to finish mine. So just for the record.
Yeah. There was another quote that I've heard that Sue said about her work, and I believe she said she would come and haunt her children if they tried to sell the books to film.
I've made them sign a blood oath that they will never sell the character to Hollywood, and I have told them I will come back from the grave and haunt them, and they know I can do it.
Just one other thing. Do you have, usually you will credit technical advisors, do you have a strong relationship in your community with that kind of resource?
In terms of writers coming up in the business?
Research.
Yes, ma'am.
Police, whatever.
I found even in the beginning of my career, people were extraordinarily generous with their time. And what I did, even early in my career, I did as much homework as I could. So when I called an expert, if I needed to call an attorney or a cop or a lawyer, attorneys and lawyers are the same thing, if I needed to go down to the morgue, I knew what I needed, and I knew I could say to people, I will not take more than 20 minutes of your time. And therefore, I was not going to local experts to have them educate me on their area since the beginning of time. And I think it is true, and I think of any of you who might be writing and need to do that kind of one-on-one research, call in advance, do your homework, be real specific about what you need, and just be real polite. People like to talk about what they do. For instance, if you talk to a banker, here's what I say to them. Did you ever think of a way of cheating the system? And they go, oh, yes. Because everybody, you know, I'll say, did you ever think of how you might kill a person if you, like, you're a sanitation worker? Oh, yes, they all know ways to do it. So just, you know, you can mine your local resources.
Do you have the same editor that you've had for a while?
Since the beginning.
Yeah.
Marion Wood, who now has her own imprint at Putnam, bought AS for Alabama on the basis of the first 65 pages. She had never edited a mystery novel, as far as I know, but it was the voice that caught her. And so she and I have been together since, actually, she got that manuscript probably 80 or 81.
That's very unusual in this business.
And I've had the same agent since B is for Burglar. I mean, I'm a loyal little thing, you know.
That's good. I think I have some other questions that I wanted to address, but there are folks in the audience who want to address the same thing.
So why don't we go to some of the questions. You write your questions down. About 900 asked about what would happen when I got to see us for zero. So I know that's kind of on your minds. I wish I could tell you. I am, as you know, you is out. I'm kind of thinking about this one. And God willing and the creek don't rise, I think I can get through the next five. But it's going to take me 10 years, given that I've been doing a book every 2 years. So I suspect most of you aren't really sure what you're going to be doing in 10 years. So we're just going to have another meeting when we get to that point. One of my goals is not to keep writing if the juice is gone. So what scares me every time I start a novel, I think maybe it's gone. How do I know I can still do this? Especially since they've been getting harder. The last three or four about killed me. And again, that's one of the virtues of keeping a journal. I have journals all the way back to GS for Gumshoe. So when I get scared or I get stuck, I can go back to the journal for KS for Killer, HS for Homicide. And just about page for page, I was just as scared back then. And it's very reassuring that I can see myself go through the same struggle in some form. One of my theories in keeping a journal is that if I don't own my emotions, if I'm writing and I'm scared or I'm baffled or I'm stuck, I need to own that and take responsibility and put that on the page. Otherwise, I think those emotions sabotage our work. So by putting them down and facing those fears, whatever they may be, I think it moves me through.
This person wants to know why it took her so long to get to Philadelphia.
Wait, Dean and I were talking about that earlier. I can't remember when I was here last. Yes, when? Do you know when I was here? Oh, when was it?
She asked a question.
Oh, you have? Oh. Well, I'll just have to come back.
Well, you understand, of course, that a lot of times it's not left up to the writer.
Right.
The publicist does the tour.
Right.
And we're glad that she found her way here, and I was trying to coax her to come back on the next one.
We'll find
a bookstore.
I'm going to read this question and then tell you a really good story. And I'm reading this question because it will inspire me. This person in the weensiest handwriting you ever saw said, when did you decide to sell out and figure quantity was more important than quality? No, but here's the good story. I did a cruise when my husband and I had been married 30 years. We did this cruise, 25, maybe it's 25. And I was on this boat, and word kind of went out that Sue Grafton was on the boat, and people were just adorable. You know, it's like little winks and waves. And so I'm walking down this corridor one day, and this woman's coming toward me with a copy of Ennis for News. So I said to her, well, I know who you're reading. And she said, oh, no, hon, I'm taking this back to the library. I don't like her. I thought it was the funniest thing. My husband said, "Do you know who this is?" She went, "No." And then she went, "Oh my God." I just loved it. I just loved that. I thought it was a, anyway, that's why I wanted to tell that story.
I was going to ask what contemporary writers Sue reads, or, you know, we've got lots of friends in the field, and somebody in the audience also asked what writers she likes.
Well, in mysteries, I like P.D. James, Ruth Rendell, writing as Barbara Vine, because I like the darker novels. Yeah, I read Michael Connelly, Robert Crace. I read Marcia. I haven't read Marcia for a while, and I got to catch up with her. Peretzky, I haven't read the latest, but I will. It's on, you know, we have that stack by the bed. I'm currently reading Malcolm Gladwell's books. I had heard about Blink, and I thought to myself, oh, it sounds like one of those novel books that should be about a paragraph long that somebody's pumped and pumped. It's just wonderful. I learned a couple of things from that, and I almost never find fresh ideas in the world. So then I read Outliers, and I just finished What the Dog Saw. He just writes wonderfully, and he's very fresh and original, and he does things that really turn my head around. So I do recommend Malcolm Gladwell.
Sue was named a grandmaster this year by the Mystery Writers of America. Yeah. And that's
with James Lee Burke. James Lee Burke and I were honored the same year. It was just
didn't want to let either of you get away. I know Marjorie. Yeah. Do you read Burke?
Oh, yeah. I read some in my field and some not in my field. Sometimes I read a mystery novel and I won't know what they're doing. It's like, don't do that to me, you know. I like to be fooled in the same way you do. So sometimes I'm more attracted to crime novels, straight crime novels, as opposed to whodunits.
You seem to like Ross McDonald.
I did. I met him twice. He lived in Santa Barbara, which is Santa Teresa to you. And his real name is Ken Millar. He was married to a gal who is a wonderful writer named Margaret Millar. And I met him twice in my life, but I was not then writing mysteries. And he was beginning to fade. He died of Alzheimer's. So at a certain point, he just began to drift off. So I can't claim that I knew him, but I did touch him once or twice. You know, I'm a fan of Raymond Chandler, not Dashiell Hammett so much, but James N. Cain. Those old guys are great.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that sometimes disturbs me when I meet some of our new writers. They have no idea of background in this field.
Yeah.
We were talking about a Philadelphia writer named David Goodis, and the name doesn't mean anything to many, many people, but there's a whole Goodis clan. He was a very excellent example of noir writing, and there's kind of been a renaissance of that field also. You talked about your style of writing, what you do, and there was a question here. Does it differ now from when you started?
Well, the field is different. There is a conference called BoucherCon, which is given by mystery fans for mystery writers. When I first started going to BoucherCon, it was 300 people. You could sit in the bar with Tony Hillerman, and he would buy you a drink. You know, it was Donald Westlake and Lawrence Block, and it was just a very tight-knit community. I went to BoucherCon in Indianapolis in October, 1,800 people, and they'd all written books. Some of them had published them very own selves, you know, and I thought, I'm quitting. I can't. It was overwhelming to me. So I miss the old days when it was just small and close-knit.
Well, if any of you have been to that convention, it can be a lot of fun. I had the opportunity to produce four of them. And as Sue said, the first one that we did was over at the Sheraton in Philadelphia, and there were 900 people, which was huge.
Right.
And the last one I did had over 3,000. And, I mean, it's a gigantic project, but you don't get the one-to-one. It used to be a fans convention.
Yes.
So you had a smaller number of writers, but you had the prestigious writers. And it's changed a lot. I would not discourage you from going. It's an experience. But you don't have the ability to...
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's
it's true. Not a place... Now it's a place maybe I can find an agent. Mm-hmm. And that's not what it's meant to be. Right. It's meant to share ideas and share books and what I think is wonderful and all that good stuff. There is an association called the International Association of Crime Writers, and they're not accepting the self-published books anymore. And I don't mean to denigrate that. I also think it's wonderful. If anybody writes a book, it's terrific. Right. But there are, you know, they're kind of standards. Talking about that, what advice would you give a beginning writer?
I'm real interested in people coming up in the business. I think if I have advice, it would be to exhibit a little patience and humility. Many people write their first novel and imagine somehow that they're going to get an agent, an editor, fame and glory. And as a rule, it doesn't happen that way. When you read in the paper that someone's publishing their first novel, it doesn't mean it's the first one they ever wrote. It means it's the first one that has reached a professional level that makes it worthy of publication. Writing is self-taught. I think it's good to take classes because it gives you structure and it gives you deadlines and it gives you some feedback. But most of the time you got to teach yourself, and how you teach yourself is by doing a lot of really bad writing and then gradually beginning to understand which sentences work, which stories work, which ideas you can pull off on the page. But it's a long process. In the old days, you know, artists had apprentices, you know, and if you wanted to be a stonemason or a master painter, you would apprentice yourself to someone who is really good, and they would mentor you and teach you. That doesn't happen anymore, so you're pretty much left to your own devices. What I do, I think you can learn a lot from reading. If I read a book that makes me laugh or cry or scares me, I go back and analyze very carefully how has the writer pulled that off. And so I keep Elmore Leonard, I love. I learn a lot from him. And you can do that on your own, too. If you find books that particularly move you, go back and watch the writer at work, because you learn a lot from that. But I just think people need to put a lot more time and attention into it than they're generally willing to do. I'm a very harsh critic, and I'm trying to be a better teacher in my life, you know. So I'm trying to be a kinder, better person than I actually am.
Did you ever work with a writer's group? I mean, there are so many of them.
You mean not a book club. You're
no,
talking
no.
about a writer's
no,
group. I'm kind of down on that. And I'll tell you, I understand people love the writer's group. You know, you get together once a week and you read your little stuff, and she reads her stuff. But I think it tends to homogenize your work. I think it's very dangerous. What you're doing, in effect, is externalizing a process that you should be teaching yourself. So instead of learning yourself what makes a good sentence, you're asking somebody else to make that judgment. The whole point of learning to write well is that you become your own judge and jury. You can't assign that to other people. If you will think about this, I want you to imagine Leo Tolstoy in a writer's group, and he's saying, I'm writing this book, and this gal at the end, she's like, goes under the train, and they're going to say, Leo, honey, that is so not commercial. Don't you think, like, it's a little dark, you know? Couldn't she just run off, you know? So, you know, great work is not done by committee, and it's not done by asking all your best friends to pat you on the back. Writing is supposed to be uncomfortable, and my worries about a writer's group is that you go and you get comfortable. You get feedback, you get pats on the back, you get a little delicate criticism, and you go away thinking you've done your job. So I know your writer's group is a great comfort to you, and I'm happy for you. But I would advise you, wherever possible, to go back and teach yourself on your own. It's really important.
Does anybody see your book before your editor?
My husband does. And if I get really scared, I don't share my work with anybody. Nobody sees it. Except once in a while, if I get really scared or if I think I'm off on the wrong track, I'll ask Steve to read it. I'll tell him I'm going to print out what I've done and have him read it. And that tells Shadow that she better shape up. So I've hardly ever had to do it, because the minute I say that to him, Shadow kind of creeps up and takes care of the job. But he is a good sounding board if I need him. So I do that occasionally. He then reads it first, and then my editor and agent read it.
We had this Sue addressed this. I'll read it anyway, because are any of Kinsey's quirks reflected in you, i.e. running and
yeah.
all that?
Oh, yeah. I walk a lot. I used to jog. 25 years I jogged, then my feet started breaking down.
Quarter pounders with cheese?
Oh, quarter pounders. I've had to give those up. Oh, that's hard. I do still eat occasionally peanut butter and pickle sandwiches.
Who submitted the question? Because they drove up from Baltimore.
My mom and my sisters. We drove from Baltimore.
All right, Mary.
Well.
Now I tell you, if you go to my website, which oddly enough is suegrafton.com, you can get my post office box number. If you write to me and spend 44 cents for a stamp, I will write back. I don't do emails. I think you should have to work harder to communicate. But my mailing list is 5,000 names. So every Christmas, you get a Kinsey Millhone Christmas card, which is really a picture of me. And then when a new book comes out, I send out my tour schedule so you can come see me. And usually, almost always, with each book, I send out a little promotional item. So I'll send an Ellis for Lawless luggage tag or an M is for Malice keychain, or for U is for Undertow, it's a little drink coaster. It has to be useful, you know. For P is for Peril, I send a little first aid kit. But those are things. I pay for all that myself. I pay my own postage. I have an assistant who will help stamp and stuff and carry on like that. And so that's fun for me. Each time a book comes out, it's like, what am I to give my readers, you know, this time? So see, if you spend 44 cents.
My children think we're related.
Well, see, one reason I send those picture Christmas cards, I think you should see how I'm holding up. I don't let them airbrush me, you know. One year they airbrushed me. I about had a fit. I want you to see every piece of suffering on my face.
This kind of goes to what you're talking about. How would modern technological advances, such as the Internet, affect Kinsey's investigative techniques?
Yeah. Well, I'm fortunate in that she's never going to get to that. When the series ends, the narrative year will be 1990. She will turn 40. Some of you might remember 40. I don't anymore. But I think it keeps her in an old-fashioned investigative mode. I know in this day and age, the technology is a great service to law enforcement. But in the end, regardless of forensics, DNA, ballistics, whatever, it still takes human beings looking at the information, putting it together, and it takes human ingenuity and skill and intelligence. So all the technology in the world does you no good if you don't have good law enforcement officers who sit in there figuring it out for you. So I think it's more fun for her. Her index cards. High tech.
This person wants to know, what do you think is harder to get published? A short story, a book, or a series?
they're all hard. Here's the deal. If you want to make money, I was once told it takes 5 years to get published and 15 years to make a living at it. And that's if you're busting your nut every day of your life. If you want to make money in publishing, you have to do long form, full length, nonfiction, the novel, you know, book length work. Because poets, poor things, can be fabulous and they just don't make money. Now, the object of writing well is not to make money, but let's get serious here. People who are passionate about writing would love the opportunity to make a living at it. So, whereas you can't do it for money, if you do it well, it's nice to have a reward. I don't think there's an easy way to do it. But here's the thing. You have to trust that if you do your work and if you really devote yourself to your craft and work to improve your writing, someone will come along and help you. Truly, people are there who will help you. It's not easy, and you have to be really good at what you do, and you have to take your lumps. You know, you're going to get rejected and knocked to your knees, but it's like the old saying goes, get knocked down 7 times and get up 8. So,
do you have any comments about the current publisher scene?
The what?
The publishers today.
Oh, see, you can't worry about it. I tell you, ever since I've been in this business, publishers have been whining about how hard it is and how expensive, blah, blah, blah. It is not your business to worry about publishing. It's not my business. I'm not in charge of that. So whatever publishing is about, however they're organizing themselves, your job, and I'm treating you as so many of you are writers, I hope that's true, your job is to write well. And if you sit around worrying about the state of publishing, that has nothing to do with writing well. So you got to focus on your craft. Go to writers' conferences. Take writing classes. You know, there's a thought. I think you can get out in the community. Writers' conferences are really good in terms of editors and agents being on the premises, reading portions of your work. So if you want that kind of exposure, it's out there. But publishing, who knows what that's about? I just don't worry about anything I can't control. So.
It's a wonderful attitude. I mean, we could all learn from it, I guess. Well, I don't know. I think you've said that. You've said.
Do you have anything there that's different? Because these are all things.
Well, they're all you're all worried about. See, I'm so sorry. Can Kinsey get a new boyfriend? Nah. When I got to Jesus for Gumshoe, I knew somebody whose daughter lived up in Mendocino, and she knew a carpenter who sent word down the coast to me, couldn't Kinsey get laid? So that's where Robert Dietz came from. And then, you know, well, she had Jonah Robb, and he turned out, I don't know where he is now. Dietz is off in Germany or something. And I just don't want to write those scenes. You know, once in a while it's okay for her to have a relationship, because she's flesh and blood. She has same desires most everybody else does. But to keep a steady boyfriend just is an impediment to her lifestyle. So,
how old is she? How old is she going to be when you get to see?
How old?
Yeah,
40.
She'll be 40.
Yeah, we're not going to watch her go through menopause.
That's great. Okay.
Well, we're almost at 8:30.
Yes. We can take one more question that doesn't address anything that we've talked about.
I love the way you start your novels with the little insight, and I'm wondering where that comes from.
She's talking about what I call the prologue. One of my jobs in the writing process, once I figure out what the story is, a decision I have to make is what I call the angle of attack. Where am I going to cut into the book? And what I like to do often, almost inevitably, is in the front, give the reader just a taste, not of what the story is, but where we're going. And so those, sometimes I can write that early in the process. Sometimes I'm further into the book, but I'm always thinking to myself, what is that first introduction to the story? And those vary. Sometimes they're tender, sometimes they're funny, you know. So well, we're going to sign your books, babe.
I think, no, I just want to thank Sue for being here, and thank you.
Thank you.
She'll be downstairs in the lobby with her new book, and I hope everybody has a chance to stop and say hello. And you were a wonderful audience. Thank you, too.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.